This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 8th of June 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound. This week we're asking, do albums need notes to help understand them? After all, art exhibitions do, TV shows come with a whopping previously on Game of Thrones style recap, and books come dressed in a cover, the back of which tells you what to expect. So why not records? To help answer this question, we'll be delving into the world of album sleeve notes. Those essays that used to accompany LPs would help to paint a picture of the record, would tell you about how it was made, and by whom. In New York, Ashley Carnes won an award for just such an endeavor.
It's sort of like being this window in on the music. You don't want to draw attention to your own words, your language, your tricky use of vocabulary, whatever. More so, you just want to be that deliverance to the music.
Deliverance, eh? Not that, but other things will be coming up here on Culture with me, Robert Bound. And we're joined by the familiar voice on the Monocle Culture Show of Will Hodgkinson from The Times. Will, welcome to the programme as ever.
Thank you.
Today we should set up what we're talking about. We're talking about album sleeve liner notes. And we can hear almost a universe of people tapping away into the Google section of the internet, wondering what on earth that is. This is an interesting thing. These are the sometimes profuse, sometimes fairly concise notes that accompany albums, classic or new or whatever. But there's often some quite good writing in here, some quite good sort of critical thought in here, especially about albums that have been reissued and all the rest of it. So let's sort of kick off with whether there was a golden age of liner notes, whether this goes hand in hand with LPs, with the big size, with sort of gatefold and all this sort of jazz, does it?
It does. There are two golden ages as far as I can work out. The first one was in the late 50s and early 60s, and this was the jazz liner note, and that was taken very, very seriously. You'd have all the great writers of the day being commissioned to write about Art Blakey or Thelonious Monk or John Coltrane, and they would be very wordy and very academic, and that was because jazz was in the process of being seen as the high art form of African Americans. You could argue that it stayed that way. The high art American music, as opposed to blues of country and folk, which is much more blue collar. So I think it really lent itself to that. But they could be also, I mean, quite impenetrable. Then what happened in the 60s was most of the pop era of the 60s, they tended to be just a bit descriptive and just saying they're fantastic. By the early 70s, I think this is the key period, you had this period of reflection. So for me, the best liner notes I can think of were by Grail Marcus, and that was for the Basement Tapes, which was the Bob Dylan and the Band album of demo recordings. The recordings were made in 67, 68, but Basement Tapes didn't come out officially until 76, 77. And it's a beautiful piece of writing. It's good enough to read and not hear the music. But what it does do is it makes you want to hear the music.
Well, we're living on the edge of the ocean. The mind be hungry, ready for crime. Oh, the three times over my twinning. Oh,
that's the sort of acid test of any great writing about music. It makes you kind of, these days, I suppose, get onto iTunes as soon as it's humanly possible to download the thing and to hear it for yourself. Presumably, this is the job of kind of great musical criticism. But this is a funny thing. This isn't something in a music magazine or The Enemy. This is not something to encourage you to buy it. This is something that you read once you've bought the album.
That's
as well.
Right.
So it's a kind of bit of bolstering of the artistic credentials of the work on the LP itself, isn't it?
It is. It's not a press release. What tends to happen, I mean, with the sort of not so interesting liner notes, they go into a lot of description and also just endless hyperbole. Well, you bought the album. You don't need to be told it's
You don't
fantastic.
Need to know that Cliff Richards is one cool daddy-o. You know that. Everyone knows that.
That's a given. And it doesn't get any better. So, you know, we know that. Now, the liner notes I like, you mentioned there's been a lot of great reissues and expensive reissues now. The liner notes I really enjoy are when they tell me the story, a great story behind the album. And so you find out there's been a lot of reissues by people like Soul Jazz. And they do these compilations of, you know, it might be Brazilian music, it might be punk, it might be country music, but they give you this context. And you know, their approach is to be almost scientific about it, quite factual. And then, you know, someone who we've mentioned in the past on this show is Johnny Trunk. He has a very comic way of describing totally obscure albums that you most likely won't have heard before. It will be some sound recording by a mad professor in, you know, Woolwich in 1978 or whatever. But he'll give it context. So that's what I like now. And I would also say I feel, sadly, that we're not really in a golden age, because I just find that bands don't seem to want line notes anymore. They don't seem to have them.
You might have been employed to have done this for bands in the past, and you feel that this is not as a shortcoming of any form of writing, but do you feel people don't want to be bigged up, or they would rather be bigged up in a different way, that maybe there's other avenues for promotion that they can explore rather than this thing? Or do you think it's simply the format? You know, people are downloading music, whether for free or not, and there's no place for these liner notes to sit physically.
I think the second more than the first. They certainly do want to be bigged up, because you and I know, as journalists, you get sent albums, you get sent press releases, the artist has hired a PR to get it out there. This is a different thing. I'm not entirely sure. Bands still clearly like albums. You know, there's been a lot of conversation about the death of the album, and yet the album still endures. You get sent albums, you buy albums. Whether you listen to them or as albums or not is different, but the band is making them as an album. So they still like that. It costs a little bit of money to commission someone to do it, not that much. You might even get your friend if you're a new band, or you might do it yourself. Maybe it's over-explaining they're worried about, but personally, I like it. When I was a student, I remember buying this album by a band called Bongwater, and great name,
yeah.
Great band, very, I mean, as you can guess, kind of psychedelic stoner, yeah. Band, but kind of ironic too,
yeah.
And Kramer, the guy that was behind Bongwater, wrote an essay for the back of Too Much Sleep, great album, and the essay had absolutely nothing to do with the music whatsoever. It was about this Great Chicago Fire of 1922 or whatever it was. Okay. It had nothing to do with it.
But it was a transcendental trip.
It really, yeah, was, and yeah, it worked. And you know, the idea was that you sit there, you roll a joint on your 33 RPM piece of vinyl, and you listen to the album, and then you sit there and try and make sense of the completely arcane and bizarre liner notes.
Presumably in that golden age of albums, maybe that was the 1970s, in fact it probably was the 1970s, and probably the golden age of smoking pot to listen to these albums as well.
I certainly think that definitely is part of it.
Yeah, there was this idea of a bit of an extra buzz going on, or a bit of extra weirdness that you could either fit with the record or it would take you on another trip entirely. And that's kind of a lovely thing. There's also presumably the fact that once an album had commissioned Psygnosis or whatever, Pink Floyd had commissioned some kind of well-known album cover designer to do this kind of like thing that folded out like trying to fold a double bed, that there needed to be some words in there, not just the pictures as well.
I think so. Yeah. I think so. And you'd find the great journalists, you know, the Nick Toshes and, yeah, Lester Bangs and all these people, they did liner notes. You know, they'd be doing liner notes for their favourite bands, you know, Big Star, whoever they were. I kind of feel there's still a place for it, and I'd like to see it.
Well, the sun came up just like every other day. I wasn't thinking about a future. I was moving through it my own way. I thought to myself, maybe I'd go get a drink. So I put on a clean shirt and grabbed my keys. Stop.
You know, I mean, I went to see this band called, do you know a band called White Denim?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's an offshoot of them called Bop English, and they were... The music was that kind of thing. It was very psychedelic, very groovy, but it was modern too. And you could just imagine a really good writer taking this album and going somewhere with it. I mean, that's what I like. Not just description, and certainly not a press release. That's definitely not what you want. It's the feeling that it's an art form.
And there's also that nice thing that, you know, I've done this as well, in the CD age mainly, but, you know, reading the liner notes of some of these fantastic records. One that you're going to roll your eyes at, which I really liked, was the really intense liner notes by Brian Eno, who was supposedly responsible for the Enosification of The Lamb Lies Down on Broadway by Genesis. And he writes some really quite
wild...
You're
showing your true colours here now.
Yeah, he writes some pretty wild liner notes in that. And it's pretty... And it, of course, it's the record is bananas, but... It's almost made sane by the craziness of the liner notes provided by Brian Eno. And there's something very rich and enriching kind of about that. And you really do get lost, joint or no joint, in something that other than simply the music and watching the record go around on the turntable.
That's very true. And you get the character. When I was a teenager, there's a collection of albums that came out. This would have been in the late 80s. And there's a collection of albums that came out called Back from the Grave. And they were obscure 60s bands, garage bands from America. The guy that put them all together was obsessive, called Tim Warren. And the liner note, he hated all modern music. He hated all music, it seemed, apart from totally obscure garage bands who never made it from about 1965 to 1966. That was the period. And, you know, it all went wrong when they discovered LSD.
Yeah.
So it's kind of crazy writing, you know, grammatically all over the place. But these weren't bootlegs. You know, he cleared them, but it had the tone of a fanzine bootleg kind of world. It was total enthusiasm, total prejudice against everything he didn't like. And he just let it splurge out. And so what you got, even though these were compilations, you weren't getting the character of the band so much, which were just, they were teenagers. You were getting the character of this maniac. And it was great. Liner notes really lend themselves to compilations. There's a very famous compilation called Nuggets, which came out in 1972, which is by Lenny Kaye, who's Patti Smith's guitarist. And that was the first time that someone had taken seriously all these one-hit wonders from the mid-60s. And he wrote these fantastic liner notes, and he sort of owned it somehow through the use of the language. Let's say somebody did liner notes on boy bands from the 1980s, something which nobody takes seriously.
It would be a very super rich subject matter.
You could do it, you know, and you say, well, no, there's an innocence here, there's fun, there's the fact that they're all manufactured, it was almost Warholian or whatever. Liner notes were a way to own something, I think, and to give it a context which people could understand and sort of almost reinvent the music.
And this kind of comes to you especially in the sort of second coming of records, when you do a kind of charity shop CD sweep and you buy five things you've kind of slightly maybe heard of but you know are dated and you know that you probably love because you hate the album cover so much or something like that. They've certainly got broken CD jewel cases.
Oh, yeah.
And you hope that the CD inside is worth a spin. And then you open up the liner notes to some of these records and you find a sort of wealth of information you never knew you wanted. Maybe no one ever knew they wanted, but it's that strange thing. It's the idea of the second coming, isn't it? Which is, I suppose, why this writing lends itself so well to CD reissues and gatefold and
all that stuff.
The luxury packaging.
It really does.
Things.
And in terms of the actual writing, I mean, often the writing's awful and it can be great like anything, but what's interesting about it is that it's not a field which anyone really takes seriously. So novels, music, obviously, journalism, these are all established forms, poetry, whatever, you know, it's all established forms, but no one has really thought about the art of the great liner note. But of course, there is an art, and there, you know, when you read really good liner notes, it stands out. And I mean, so often they're just unreadable. For me, it makes the music a lot more exciting. I mean, there are albums I've bought of obscure stuff, you know, past stuff, which has been rediscovered, and the liner notes are so annoying and pretentious that it puts me off the music.
That's the horrible thing, isn't it? When something is so overwrought in its praise, or is trying to find such artistic credentials,
or showing off,
squeezing the pips out of every reference they can possibly glean.
Exactly.
But you're essentially pitching yourself as the Grail Marcus for Westlife.
For me, well, it's a commission that I haven't yet received, but you know.
Now that is a challenge worth any great music writer's salt. Presumably,
I think that's a true challenge.
Reinterpret the 90s boy band compilation.
Exactly. When the
what would we call it if it wasn't Nuggets?
Oh, God, I don't know. Boys only. I don't know. I don't know. I don't want to think about it.
No, let's not think about it. That was Will Hodgkinson, rock and pop critic for The Times. Onwards we go then, asking the question, do albums need notes to help understand them? We caught up with Ashley Khan, a recent recipient of a Grammy for his album Notes, writing about John Coltrane, and one of the most respected men in his field. A prolific writer and a university lecturer, Khan also spent 12 years on the road, managing everyone from Ladysmith Black Mambazo to a teenage Britney Spears. Monocle's New York bureau chief Ed Stocker spoke to Ashley.
I believe that the art of creating great liner notes really comes down to being a good storyteller. I mean, great music writing is great writing. first and foremost. But if you can get all the information in and do it in such a way that it, you know, enraptures the listener and creates a depth of appreciation for the music that goes beyond what they even expected, to a level that they did not envision going to, that's really what I think the liner notes should do. They should enhance, they should deepen the appreciation, or in some cases, the absolute love of the music that is happening on the recording that the notes are affixed to.
Tell me, what are the restrictions, or what are the things you have to bear in mind when you're writing liner notes as opposed to, say, a newspaper article or a book?
Well, the difference with liner notes is that you're really there to celebrate it and to elevate it. So the critical viewpoint really kind of gets minimized. But at the same time, if it's something like Layla and Another Assorted Love Songs by Derek and the Dominoes, which I recently did 14,000 words on, that really is very easy to celebrate because it has been proven to be a timeless classic. And so the questions you're answering are more, why is this timeless? What about this elevates it beyond what else was being recorded in 1970 or other Eric Clapton projects of that time? So those are the questions you're really trying to answer. Of course, the whole nature of musical taste and musical taste over time is its own kind of animal. Much of that you can't explain. Why is Kind of Blue Miles Davis's most popular, best-selling effort to date? It is, and you can take it apart and look at all the different elements, the Sidemen, the year 1959, the compositions, Miles's approach to modality in jazz. But that never fully explains it. The liner notes are more like a doorway into that discussion, not the end all of that discussion.
One of the legends of liner notes has just passed. Tell us about him and what made him so special.
Well, one of the legends of album note writing has to be Stan Kornin, who was head of creative services at Warner Brothers, Warner Music, in the late 1960s through the 70s. He helped also find a way of getting the compact disc into a reality. Stan Kornin was a Grammy Award winner for his notes on Frank Sinatra in the mid-60s, Sinatra at the Sands, and also Sinatra's Joe Beam album. And his way of writing was very different from what album note writing is now. Back then, he was talking about music that was new and hitting the market for the first time. He brought a literariness and an incredibly strong voice that was both irreverent and reverent at the same time. It was obvious that this guy loved the music with a deep, deep passion, but he also wasn't going to write like everyone else. And Stan Kornin's notes, you can still find them online, it's worth Googling, speak to the possibilities that one can have when one's writing about music.
I mean, talking of lauded liner note writers, you yourself have just won a Grammy for album note writing. Tell me how that felt, winning that prize.
It was nothing short of amazing, you know, to win in the album note category at the Grammys, to find the right suit to wear, to get your words together, you know, for the John Coltrane Offering album, which is a first-time issue of his very famous 1966 Temple University concert. It was sort of a double honor. The fact that I won for Coltrane was huge in and of itself. I used my moment up there when I got up to the mic to really speak about the category, to thank the Academy for keeping this category alive.
Well, I want to talk about that, actually, because the music industry is in obvious flux and people are downloading. How does that work? Are people still consuming liner notes? Are digital albums coming with liner notes? And really, how do you see the future of that market?
That's a question we are all asking ourselves. You know, liner notes is part of what's called packaging. It's part of the physical package of compact discs, before that vinyl, etc. And nowadays, with downloading and streaming, there's less and less of a demand for that information, even to the point of not knowing who's playing on certain albums. I just downloaded Kendrick Lamar's album, and I noted that there's a PDF attached to it. So when you buy the whole album, you get a PDF that lists all the players. And I think that's great. If that can continue, fantastic. I don't have much confidence in the market forces currently at work that they're going to push the idea of album covers, credits, and liner notes as a priority.
Obviously, Stan Kornin had his very particular approach. What is your personal approach like?
My personal approach, if I have a philosophy of album note writing, is to be the sort of bridge between words and music. I want listeners, as a result of reading whatever I wrote, to go back to the music. I don't want it to stop there. I don't want it to be the be-all or end-all. And if I've achieved that, then I've been successful. So it's sort of like being this window in on the music. You don't want to draw attention to your own words, your language, your tricky use of vocabulary, whatever. More so, you just want to be that deliverance to the music, that conveyance between listener and music.
That was historian and Grammy Award-winning sleeve note writer Ashley Khan speaking to Monocle's Ed Stocker. But why? Because we're answering the question, do albums need notes to help understand them? Pictures on the Radio next. As important as what goes inside the album sleeve is what it looks like on the outside. We could easily do a whole show, a whole series on album design, and perhaps we will soon. But for a taster, we're heading to Portland, Oregon. Melanie Sevchenko meets two album designers, one from Portland and the other from Austin, Texas, to discuss how they've had to adapt their craft to meet the needs of a shifting music industry.
I'm lucky in that I can execute the design and the imagery. Generally, that would be compartmentalized, and so you'd be collaborating with someone else.
Ryan Obermeyer is a critically acclaimed visual artist and designer based in Austin, Texas. He's most widely known for his surreal digital photographs appearing on album art and promotional materials for recording artists like Garbage, Rye, and Grammy Award-winning musician Imogen Heap.
Because I do the full package, I can think about all aspects as I'm creating it, so they can be more cohesive. I'm just given a lump of text. You know, if there's lyrics or credits or, you know, any titles, I can design it in an artful way.
And when it comes to the imagery, Obermeyer says the design is often inspired by the lyrics or the structure of a song, or simply asking the musician about his or her vision for the album cover.
All of my collaborations have been with artists directly, so we felt like kids, you know, and the record label was like the parents, so we could do what we wanted.
Imogen Heap's single, Good Night and Go, is a lyrically playful song about the singer's infatuation for a person she's admiring from afar.
My concept was to have her sort of in this Alice in Wonderland context where she's chasing a white rabbit, so it, you know, stayed light and didn't seem like stalkery.
The result for the cover was a lenticular design, which gives an image the illusion of depth or movement, depending on which angle you look at it.
I ended up designing four images for one cover, so the lenticles on the CD actually only let your eye perceive one of the images at a time.
Holding the album, you can rotate it slightly to see a narrative of Imogen Heap following a white rabbit up an escalator in what looks like a metro station.
My process is unique in that I will shoot a series of photos that serve as a palette. So like I'll shoot an artist, I'll shoot a background. It's not usually on location. I'll shoot props that I construct. I take all of these components that I've shot and I'll collage them digitally in Photoshop into like a seamless image. I mean, I come from a painting background, so a lot of what I do is painting digitally.
Obermeyer recalls his first album design for the band Rasputina, a cello act from New York City that's toured with Porno for Pyros, Marilyn Manson, and Susie Sue.
I was pretending to have more experience than I had, and I was a fan, so I was really nervous. So I used my friend's body, and I sort of just transplanted the head of the singer onto my friend's body because I was too nervous to, like, have a legitimate shoot with her. So I ended up needing to shoot her anyway, but I was trying to avoid it. So I have some unusual techniques that I employed for that.
In Portland, Oregon, musician and graphic designer Eric Mast runs his own experimental label, Audio Dregs. Since 1996, the label is responsible for over 50 releases from international artists, with Mast designing most of the covers. He also releases his own music under the name E-Rock. Influenced by 1960s psych rock design and DIY punk aesthetics, his designs sometimes incorporate other pieces of art in the album sleeve, like short narratives or paintings. But due to limited budgets, Mast often ends up finding creative ways to package the albums. In one instance, he actually photocopied the album inserts because he had a friend who worked at Kinko's.
I did a lot of covers, right? Just silkscreened the covers myself for records I put out. So I'd spend like 4 days working on that. But now I spend like 2 weeks updating social media. It's a different thing. It's like not physical, it's being online.
The online aspect is less rewarding for Mast. Traditionally, he would approach an album design with simple sketches using ink on paper.
Usually the first step was listening to the music and just drawing things by hand. And then I scan it and do all the layout and coloring on the computer. But usually I just start with like black and white drawings. I like there to be like as much real world aspects as possible.
For Mast, the vinyl record is still king.
People are still doing LPs. I mean, it's still a strong format. Because for the most part, the CD was created to resell LPs in like a new format. But now no one really does CDs anymore. People don't make as many physical objects anymore as far as album covers.
Ryan Obermeyer agrees.
Record companies' profits are down, so design and photographer fees and packaging are the first things to go. On the other hand, they sometimes make packaging more elaborate to entice people to buy the actual package and not download it.
Even so, nothing can stop music listeners from downloading MP3s. And because of this, designers are more often creating digital covers for albums that exist only online or as files.
Vinyls used to be 12 inches by 12 inches canvas, and now we're working with 5-inch by 5-inch canvases, and then there's internet-only 1-inch canvas, you know. Album art is a dying art, I feel, unfortunately.
But at least we have our old collections to sift through, where the album art is synonymous with the music. For Monocle, in Portland, I'm Melanie Savchenko.
Thanks, Melanie. And there we have it. Today we were asking, do albums need notes to help understand them? The answer is no. But wouldn't it be nice if they came with a little list of instructions anyhow? We enjoyed the golden age of the album liner note when big name writers would wax lyrical about the music on the disc. We like the scene setting and the fact you can win a Grammy for it. And it's led us into a rich topic for the future, all about the good old album cover itself. You've been listening to Culture on Monocle 24. My producer was Holly Fisher, who obviously wrote the album sleeve notes for this little endeavour. So join us again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bound, and thank you very much for tuning in.